Right, hello. Welcome to our opening session of our first ever conference, the Future Pharmacist Conference. And do you know, if we're going to have a Future Pharmacist Conference sort of focused on Scotland, we've got to go to the top and work down, haven't we? We've got to start with the Chief Pharmaceutical Officer and new in post as well. So on the line, we've got Professor Alison Strath, I should say. So Alison is the recently appointed Chief Pharmaceutical Officer for Scotland and Honorary Professor at RGU. Excellent. Alison, how are you doing today?
I'm really good, thank you, Jonathan. Thanks for inviting me as well to come and speak today.
Well, it's great. It's lovely to have you. And I don't know if you're like the rest of my guests at this conference. I decided early on to ban PowerPoint, so hopefully that was a plus when the invite dropped in.
Always, actually, although I have tried to move away from PowerPoint that has lots of bullet points on it to something that's more pictorial, because then you can sometimes just change the emphasis depending on who's speaking before or after you as well. So, but yes, it's welcome not to have to think about developing a PowerPoint.
Perfect. So, I mean, you're in Scottish pharmacy, your career hitherto speaks for itself. I mean, I remember being sitting on the Royal Pharmaceutical Society board and checking the wall behind me, and Alison Strath was on it. So I don't know whether you want to maybe describe a little bit about your career, because I think there'll be a lot of people, I suppose, like me, who are in and around pharmacy that know you. And I've met you through Robert Gordon, and you know, you've been very helpful to me and others in the past. But I wondered if you might want to sort of, before we start some questions, sort of share a little bit about, I mean, I suppose, how on earth do you get to become Chief Pharmaceutical Officer for Scotland? I mean, it's amazing.
Well, I suppose if I just go back to my student days, I've always had a really active interest in pharmacy politics, and was chair of our kind of pharmacy student association in Robert Gordon University when I was there. It was actually RGIT at the time. And so I guess from that stemmed into various interests in some of the kind of pharmacy organisations as I became an early career pharmacist. My background is in community pharmacy, although clearly, as you've alluded to, I've also worked in academia as well. But I was kind of an active member of the British Pharmaceutical Students Association, the Young Pharmacist Group. And then I guess local Royal Pharmaceutical Society branch. And from there stemmed my interest into thinking about how to play an active part in the Scottish branch of the Royal Pharmaceutical Society. My very first employer was Graham Miller, who was actively involved in pharmacy politics and actually chaired the equivalent of Community Pharmacy Scotland at the time, as the negotiator for community pharmacy in Scotland. So he also encouraged my interests, and I joined the Scottish board and eventually became vice chair and chair of the Scottish board. And I was really lucky because I did that during the sesquicentenary anniversary of the Royal Pharmaceutical Society, easy for some to say, and had a great opportunity to influence what became our first pharmacy strategy in Scotland, the Right Medicine, through my role in coming in to meet with ministers and talking about the potential of the pharmacy profession. But of course, I can't say I did that all by myself, and we worked really closely with the equivalent of Community Pharmacy Scotland at the time, and with the equivalent of the directors of the pharmacy group at the time, so that we presented a kind of, I suppose, a joined up version of what the pharmacy profession could bring into that kind of evolving health agenda in Scotland, because it was really at the start of the Scottish Parliament and the start of us really starting to, I suppose, set out quite a kind of ambitious agenda for how we wanted to deliver health services in Scotland. And of course, the Right Medicine then really came setting out how pharmacy could contribute across all sectors of the profession in doing that. So that's a little bit of my background. From completing my chairmanship of the Royal Pharmaceutical Society, I spent a little bit of time working with the National Pharmacy Association as their coordinator for Scotland, and which really gave me the opportunity to go out and work closely with health boards and with community pharmacy contractors in terms of thinking about service development. And that took me then into the opportunity that arose from the right medicine being launched and the need to maybe think about how we develop some of the kind of community pharmacy services. And myself and a colleague came and started working with Scottish Government to think about how we could take forward some of those kind of community pharmacy ambitions. So that's really where things like the what was the minor ailment service and is now obviously our well-known pharmacy first service, I was involved in the very early stages of testing them through evaluation and then growing them into services that worked in two health boards and then taking that to implement it across Scotland. So lots of really exciting opportunities there, and I guess that really got me interested in a role in government in terms of being able to think about how to both represent the profession and the opportunities that were presented, but also to think about, I guess, the important part about how pharmacy contributes into the agenda of the government of the day and how we solve some of the kind of tricky things that come along from time to time. And I guess, you know, we've had a swine flu pandemic and we now have had the COVID-19 pandemic. So both areas which take you into, I suppose, a slightly different area in terms of your roles and responsibilities, but nevertheless really important. And I guess, you know, in case I don't remember to say this later on, but it would be remiss of me not really at this point to thank all sectors of the pharmacy profession, including all pharmacy support teams and technicians and others, for what they've done in terms of supporting the phenomenal response to the COVID-19 pandemic. And I'm incredibly proud of how each and every person in our profession and associated professions has responded. So that probably is a little bit of a kind of overview of where I've come from and how I've ended up in the role, Jonathan.
Perfect. I mean, mentioning swine flu, I'm going to take a bit of a segue here. I've got some chickens and name check to Lindsay Steele up in Orkney, who I was speaking to recently. She's also got chickens, a GP pharmacist lead up there. And the mention of swine flu makes me nervous, but also I saw in the news, not to cause panic, but there was an isolated case of bird flu, avian flu, identified down in England. But how the world has changed, Alison, you know, all these existential things. I mean, COVID we'll come on to, obviously, but I want to find out about you a bit first, though, if that's okay. Because you are, like, whether you like it or not, I mean, you have got the job. I don't want this to appear like a job interview. You have got the job. And that must be incredibly exciting to be the chief pharmaceutical officer for Scotland. Many folk would like to sit in your shoes. And I'm sure now that you've got it, there'll be lots of advocates, but the political saboteurs will be lurking as well. That is the lie of the land, and that is the reality of it. But this is the Future Pharmacists Conference, and I want to be positive and you know, present a way forward, hopefully, for the profession in Scotland. So, and with that in mind, you know, I know you mentioned pharmacy teams, and I make no apology for calling this the Future Pharmacist Conference, because it is, you know, I am a pharmacist, I'm a member of the pharmacist profession, and that's good. That should not take away from the incredible teams that I've worked with over the years. And, you know, I've written at length, just look up. Beside every good pharmacist, there's an amazing pharmacy technician on PEPA. You know, I've been there and I'm very appreciative. It's not to dismiss that, but I think this is a key point for the pharmacist profession in Scotland. So with that in mind, what does it mean to you to be a pharmacist?
I guess what it means to me to be a pharmacist, it's actually all about... It's actually what it means to others that I think is more important. So from my point of view, and I've always been a great believer in the fact that it's in how we serve our communities and how we serve the groups that we represent that's important. So I guess for me, regardless of where you work in pharmacy, you're making a really valuable contribution, which is in terms of how... And that has an impact in terms of individual patient care or population-based care. But it also sometimes is just about how you make people feel or how you identify and signpost them to where a more relevant person to help them can be. So I guess it means many things, but what I see in the pharmacy profession is that kind of caring, community focused resource. And when I say community focused, I mean just in the community it serves, and that could be in a hospital setting or in community pharmacy or in primary care, but with a focus on that kind of local community. And by doing the best for your local community, I think that you then do the best for your profession. So I kind of look at it, I suppose, in a slightly different way. But you know, to me, the way that pharmacists and pharmacy technicians and other pharmacy support staff have responded to COVID-19, how they've adapted their services, how they've reached out and made sure that their patient populations were safe and could access you know, advice or medicines, and or, you know, introduce new services to be more responsive to allow that kind of ongoing support, how they've adapted to using remote consultations as well as face-to-face consultations. All of these things, I think, are part of, you know, being a profession and the kind of the traits of a profession and the key aspects around, you know, your focus on those people and those communities that you serve.
Very good. I suppose I don't wanna beat about the bush. Like I really want to know, and I'm sure many others do, like, you know, what is your vision? So to set up this bit of the chat, like you mentioned previous chief pharmaceutical officers, or you hinted at some of the work you've done with them. So Rosemary Parr, Bill Scott years ago. And you're right, we all know that, you know, people in Scotland know all these documents very well. We were born and raised with them in our undergraduate training. So the right medicine, you know, that was the genesis of minor ailments and this sort of move away from supply function to a degree whilst maintaining the network. Prescription for excellence, the bit, you know, the one-liner that stuck in my mind when I read that for the first time was every pharmacist should be a prescriber. That was just like, wow, okay. Globally, that was a very big statement to make. And then Rosemary came in with achieving excellence in pharmaceutical care. So we've got the right medicine, prescription for excellence, and achieving excellence. So what's your catchphrase?
Well, I'm not going to be pinned down to catchphrase just quite yet, Jonathan. So I guess the first thing I want to say is that I'm very conscious that that people are really tired. It's been a very long and relentless 18 months, and we're entering another challenging time for the NHS as we go into the winter period. And so, you know, pharmacy, wherever its place, will be stretched in the same way that other NHS care, health and care, social care professionals will be. And equally, I don't think in the middle of a pandemic, trying to write a new strategy is quite the right thing to do. So my focus I've got two or three focuses in the immediate time. The first is around pharmacy workforce. So I think for me, it's really important that we actually support our workforce as best we can, and we ensure that they're motivated and enthusiastic, regardless of whatever role or sector that they work in, and that they're empowered and strengthened to do the job to the very best of their ability. So there's something in there about resilience and about how we support people in challenging times, but there's also something, and for example, that can be for example, using the new National Wellbeing Hub, which Scottish Government's established, which is a really great way to, and has a lot of resources to help individuals manage their health and wellbeing. But I also think it's about thinking about how we strengthen our kind of workforce planning in a way that helps us make sure we can deliver the right care in the right place at the right time. And that's also responding to the shift in the balance of care, because COVID has meant we've done things differently and some things won't back, I don't think. So what's amazed me is there's been an amazing response to people recognising the role of pharmacists and pharmacy teams in supporting the response to COVID. And it feels like everybody right now wants a pharmacist on their team, but people have heard me say this before, you know, we exist in an ecosystem, and if we pinch one part of it, we feel it in another. So for me, thinking about pharmacy workforce is really important. There's not a silver bullet which is going to address all the kind of challenges that we face. But I do think we need to get on the front foot and be able to build a solution that works for the profession. So my plan is to set up a workforce forum, and I want to involve all sectors of the pharmacy profession in that. And really what I want us to be able to do is to co-produce a vision for workforce, which sets out what good looks like in 12 months, in 3 years, in 5 years, and in 10 years. Now, 5 and 10 years are quite difficult to predict, so it's going to have to be a bit iterative and we'll have to do some scenario planning, but we can probably do a lot around what 12 months and 3 years looks like. And I think what we need to do is not just think about how pharmacy operates right now, but we need to think about some of the new emerging roles that are coming along. We need to think about younger pharmacists who are quite often interested in more portfolio careers and therefore maybe not being tied to one particular setting, but being able to kind of move around those settings and bring that knowledge and expertise to different places and where they're seeing patients. And we also need to think about, I suppose, the other interdependencies such as service redesign, some of the transformation work that's taking place, how we use technologies and artificial intelligence, for example, and what we need to do to respond to some of the new, more disruptive medicines or precision medicines that are coming along. So there's quite a lot in there, but I think that is a really important place for us to really start focusing on, and that's my number one priority. The next thing I'm looking to is our NHS recovery plan and programme for government. So they both set out quite a lot of areas of work for us as a profession in terms of moving forward. So they reference the work that I have commissioned through Christine Gilmore to look at enabling the transformation of hospital pharmacy, because I feel we've probably neglected that a little bit over the years. But also there's a number of aspects in there for community pharmacy. So there's commitments around bridging contraception, which clearly is moving forward now, with a step towards the provision of longer acting contraception, redesigning community pharmacy unscheduled care services, thinking about the establishment of early adopter sites to look at how we might have community pharmacists supporting hospital discharge, and the provision of systemic anti-cancer therapies. And there's other commitments in there around obviously the links to the Women's Health Plan, and various issues like that. So there's quite an ambitious agenda there in the first place. And I think we need to think about a roadmap. And in fact, I was speaking to Community Pharmacy Scotland about this yesterday, about a roadmap that allows us to kind of plan the introduction of these in a sensible way as we go through the next kind of couple of years, and we get the order of them right. And then I guess the third thing is obviously around the work we're doing in pharmacotherapy. So a new memorandum of understanding. One of the key things for me is ensuring that we've got the various pharmacy players contributing to the top of their license. So making sure that our pharmacists are involved in doing more polypharmacy and medication reviews, focusing in on high-risk patients and high-risk medicines. And we're using pharmacy technicians, for example, to deliver other aspects of the pharmacotherapy service. And so going back to workforce, part of our kind of thinking will be around increasing the pipeline of pharmacy technicians and pharmacy support workers to underpin aspects of pharmacotherapy. So I think there's quite a lot there to focus ourselves on immediately. And then there'll be other aspects that come along, such as obviously the considerations around supervision, which of course happen at a GB stroke UK level, but there'll be other aspects that we need to think about and how they actually support delivery of our overall services. But alongside that, I do want to make sure that we do have a new strategy, because they are the things that we pin the kind of 5 to 8 year plan on. So I'm hoping that as we work through some of these priorities that are already in place, we've got the opportunity then to stand back and think about what does the bigger picture look like, and how does that build on the work we've done. And you mentioned previous chief pharmaceutical officers. You're absolutely right, Jonathan. My quote always is, I stand on the shoulders of giants and I see further. And it's the work that my colleagues have done before that really allows us, I think, to have a platform to continue to develop and move forward on. So I'm really keen to take the baton and take us to the next stage of the race. But hopefully that just gives a bit of a flavour for some of the kind of priorities and what I'm thinking I want to do in the first couple of years, but alongside that kind of wider 5 to 8 year plan.
No, it's brilliant. It's brilliant. Really good. I don't want this to be like a Q&A. I do want a bit of a conversation. There's a few things you said there that are really encouraging, actually. So, like, I don't know, but I'm guessing, and I should declare I don't have a vested interest in the workforce situation, but I'm guessing that is a pretty noisy item in your inbox. You know, that's something that's trying to grab your attention. I don't know. My own view on that is a lot of that is supply and demand, and I think the market will sort it out. That said, there's a lot of people in the ecosystem now below you that are, as you've rightly articulated, that are feeling the pain. You know, the contractor network, it's tough. Locums, it's tough. But so, you know, locum rates are now recovering, and I know you won't reveal it, but I wonder, will there be a movement back into community pharmacy? I suspect if the money's right, there will be. But I wouldn't expect you to answer that. You can if you like, but
And well, I was going to say, Jonathan, I'd maybe move it away from money and say that actually, I mean, I think if that there are a number of factors. I think if community pharmacy offers a promising clinical career, because that's what I think pharmacists go into pharmacy to do, then they will absolutely follow. And I think that the work that we've been doing, and credit to Community Pharmacy Scotland, because they have worked really hard on this, the work we've been doing around ensuring that we have a prescribing role for those. If you think about the initial education and training of pharmacists, in 5 years' time, people are going to come out of university with a prescribing qualification. You already have one. But the work that we're doing around, we've put in place Pharmacy First, which allows, and Pharmacy First Plus, which allows people to use either PGDs or their prescribing skills to treat a wider range of conditions. The work we're doing around medicines care and review, I think, also starts to really bring that kind of medication review focus in there. So I think there's really exciting clinical opportunities there, and the work we're doing to ensure that we grow our independent prescribing workforce from the pharmacists out there right now who are working in community pharmacy. I think they're the kind of things that make people say this is a really rewarding place to work, and I can make a real difference for patients. I think alongside that, we need to make sure that people are working in environments that are safe, that are well staffed, and that we're giving people the education and training that they require to continue to develop. So I was really excited last week. The Cabinet Secretary went out to visit the Golden Jubilee Hospital. So you'll remember doing your prescribing training that we worked very closely with the medical school in Dundee, and some of the other medical schools to do some of that advanced clinical skills training. And we've now embedded some of that in the NHS Academy that's based in the Golden Jubilee Hospital, and pharmacists are being able to go in there and develop those advanced clinical skills. So, you know, we're kind of spreading that resource and those kind of training opportunities for people. So I think if we get that balance and mix right, then people will see community pharmacy as being a really rewarding place to work, and we'll get the equilibrium right about, you know, how people, you know, which sectors they feel they're most affiliated to working with. Equally, that's why I want the transformation of hospital pharmacy to again make sure we've got pharmacists who are a fairly restricted resource, how we make sure we've got them working in the right places, and again using those prescribing skills to really make a difference to the clinical teams that they're practicing with and to patient care.
It's very difficult, and you've hinted at some of the challenges. You know, I don't want it to be like a negative conversation at all. It's just a really hard time. It's really tough. But I guess as a selfish pharmacist, I want to know, like, you know, really, I want to know what do you intend to do with all those prescribers? Because, you know, in your last sort of paragraph or two there, you mentioned patient group directions. Now, there's nothing wrong with patient group directions at all. In fact, they've enabled the profession. And actually, one of our sessions in this conference is around, you know, are they holding pharmacists back? And actually, to date, I don't think they are. But I guess to you know what I pers it's just my personal view, Alison. So let's have a chat. But personally, what I don't want to hear is like we're hanging our hat on PGDs, because there's a strong, you know, we're talking on one hand, back to PFE, Prescription for Excellence, every pharmacist should be a prescriber. And then we fast forward to today, we've got this incredible legislative change opportunity around every pharmacist becoming a prescriber in a few years. But if policy and the strategy is hanging on PGDs, there's a strong disincentive, I should say, for pharmacists just to tick the boxes. And actually, I reckon PGD should be done by pharmacy technicians because I think it's a technical task. What do you reckon?
So I think it's a really good point. I see PGDs right now as being the stabilizers on the bicycle. So until we get people with the skills, the independent prescribing qualification, we need a way of being
Totally
able
agree.
to extend that. But equally, I want to avoid paint by numbers, because I think at the end of the day, we're pharmacists, we call ourselves the experts in medicines. And therefore, we need to step up to the plate. So you're right, Jonathan. We've got a workforce that are going to come out very shortly with those independent prescribing skills. As a profession, we need to welcome that, and we need to make sure that we don't hold them back, because as much as I love our profession, we can be a little bit risk averse sometimes. And therefore, we're used to checking the work of others, and I hope we don't start checking our own newly qualified pharmacists' work as they come on board with those prescribing qualifications. But we give them the opportunities to learn in the same way we do for foundation year doctors, for example. So I think there's a lot for us to learn from other professions, great opportunities for us, because we will have a skilled workforce coming out. We need to make sure we give everyone else the equal opportunity to kind of get a catch up on that. I agree. I had a conversation yesterday about vaccinations, in fact, where actually I think the last thing I want is a pharmacist undertaking a vaccination, but I'd really be pleased to see pharmacy technicians and other members of the staff being able to work under a PGD to do that, because that seems to me to be a more appropriate use of skill mix. But right now, the PGDs are those stabilisers that allow us to extend, I guess, what we can do under the existing medicines legislation to treat a wider group of patients, particularly when the NHS is under a bit of pressure right now. But ultimately, we want to get to the point where we don't need the PGDs. People are using those prescribing qualifications. And that means the universities also need to think about the education and training that supports independent prescribing. So for community pharmacists, whilst right now the focus has been very much around developing your independent prescribing in a particular clinical area, I think for community pharmacists support Pharmacy First, they need to be able to work across that range of common clinical conditions, and to have the kind of confidence to be able to, almost do that differential diagnosis and know when to treat and when to refer, and to be able to do some of those advanced clinical skills to be able to, I guess in the past, as pharmacists, we haven't really been taught how to touch people, but actually sometimes in a diagnosis you need to be able to do that. So teaching people how best to use those wider advanced skills is really important. So that's where I'm coming from. So I agree with you. I think PGDs could be restrictors if we don't break the shackles of them, but they're right now I think they have a helpful purpose.
Yeah, I mean it's an existential, like it is an existential issue for our profession. You know, if we're painting by, as you said it, painting by numbers, then are we really a profession in that particular activity? You know, I'm not sure we are actually, but that's my view. I think what you said about Pharmacy First, so your vaccination point is a really good one, and as you can see, I'm moving around a lot more, getting animated. An interesting model there, and it ties into some of the work we're doing around competence-based learning, micro-credentialing, opening the door and giving the space for community pharmacists and other pharmacists to demonstrate their competence. I know you know this, but one of the tremendous insights that I've had in my career was being enveloped in a multidisciplinary general practice team. I mean, as a pharmacist, working out in the community, to be honest, chasing the numbers a bit, to be honest, I mean that hasn't changed. There's not a much, not a lot, not an awful lot of chat about that in community pharmacy, but that does go on to then go into the GP practice sort of medical model of training. Wow, I mean that was incredible. Supervision, competence-based learning, feedback, getting the old kick in the arse. What were you doing there, Jonathan? You know, that real in the moment support. Amazing. And then backed up by the competence frameworks as well. How my black hole with all this is, like, I think pharmacy first is like, right, I think this is a fair way to put it, because we really need pharmacy first to work. We need it to work for a number of reasons in my view. So where I think that would solve a lot of your workforce crisis, you know, an attractive place to work, clinical skills, all of that. It all works. And Scottish government have unusually in the UK actually put their money where their mouth is, and they've put money behind it, which is brilliant. I feel it, and I know you like football and rugby, I think you support Dundee from memory, but
Dundee United. I'll just correct you there for
Dundee
the record.
United, oh my goodness. What an error. Oh my God. Dundee United. So I think pharmacy first. I think this is not unfair to say this, right? So it's like a striker has made a break, clean through on goal, but we haven't quite scored the goal yet. And I suppose my question for you around all of this is a really positive one, because it's an opportunity, you know, it's exciting, and but the realist in me just doesn't see where the infrastructure is to actually make that happen. So I'm thinking competence frameworks, I'm thinking supervised practice. You know, if you're talking about common clinical conditions, I mean, that's actually one of the riskiest clinical areas to start working. And you talk to any GP and they're very nervous about people walking off the street with undifferentiated stuff. So I've said my piece, but what's your view on all of that? Have you got any sort of thoughts or plans or thinking around that?
I've got some early thinking which needs to be socialised with colleagues around that. But I mean, I suppose, first of all, Jonathan, just going back to your point about pharmacy first, I mean, I guess let's not forget that doing differential diagnosis has been something community pharmacists have done since, you know, forever.
Fair
So
point.
people walking off the street and they make those decisions about whether to, you know, sell a medicine over the counter or whether to refer them to another healthcare professional. And what we've done through the Minor Ailments Service and through Pharmacy First is basically make that part of a structured NHS service. And if I look at Pharmacy First, which came in just over a year ago in the middle of the pandemic, there's been over 2 million consultations that have taken place, and over 90% of those have been dealt with at the point of contact by a member of the pharmacy team. So that's pretty impressive, and only 4% have required a referral to another healthcare professional. So we think about some of the pressures that primary care is under, that has to be making, you know, a difference, whilst we can't absolutely pinpoint it. If I dip down into some of the kind of common clinical conditions that we've introduced under patient group direction, so shingles, urinary tract infections, skin conditions, impetigo, we've actually seen over 200,000 consultations in that space alone, from what we can see from the data. So, you know, that's a fairly impressive track record, I think, in terms of taking pressure off primary care. And so that whole bit about managing demand and being part of the team is really important. But you raised some interesting points for me around what we can learn from other professions. And I think going back to undergraduate education training, we need to do much more around interprofessional learning so that we value the contribution that healthcare professionals make as we learn to work together at undergraduate level, and then into what we do when we're in the real world. And I guess some of that also needs to play through into our thinking about postgraduate education. So rather than doing some of that in professional silos, we should be doing more of that together. And, you know, I think NESS are to be commended for the work that they've done around some of their PB, I won't remember the acronym, but anyway, but some of their sort of small group learning, which has been interprofessional.
Oh yes,
But
I know the one you mean. Yeah.
yes, I know. I don't have my crib sheet with me today to remember the title, but I also think there's something about, you're right, thinking about what does that kind of ongoing career pathway look like? How does that link to that kind of lifelong learning approach? And so I guess some of the things I want to do is speak to colleagues both in academia, within the NHS, and within the service, those people on the front ground, because actually the people on the front ground are the best people to be involved in trying to, I think, find solutions to your problems, because they know more about them than anyone else. But there's something for me about what does that future postgraduate kind of education piece look like? And so some of it I think has to be interprofessional. I'm not sure of the value of MScs anymore because we have Masters of Pharmacy graduating from universities. But what are the bits within that that are useful that we might not want to completely lose? How does that link, for example, to being part of a profession and therefore how you generate your own body of evidence around best practice? So, do we need to see more professional doctorates and more people working in a more academic environment to develop some of our thinking about what works and what doesn't work? But equally, how do we also think about what are the things we need to be able to continue to do our jobs as best we can? And that takes you into that piece around competence, I guess, and what we do about revalidation and, and some of the aspects of, again, what we can learn from other professions about kind of the value and importance of review and feedback. So I think there's work for us there to do, and that's fine because I guess as we start to develop into providing more of these clinically focused and kind of patient-facing services and roles, we need that time to think, well, how does the kind of underpinning lifelong learning then deliver the best way that we can actually kind of demonstrate that and be confident in ourselves that we're doing the jobs to the very best of our abilities, which is what all of us as health professionals want to do.
Yeah, I listen to you with such optimism. I don't want to detach too far from reality. I know it is really tough out there at the moment, and you've mentioned workforce already. I don't want to labour that, but it's really hard. And I don't know whether it's the culture wars or the nature of social media or what have you. I don't know what's driving the sort of division across society, really, not just across the profession, but I don't I listen to you speak about where you want to get to, and I find it really optimistic, Alison. I think for pharmacy first, if we're looking at that for sake of this conversation, you're absolutely right. We've got to look at a multidisciplinary, competence based moving towards being led perhaps by consultant pharmacist. People, I mean, for example, one thing that I would love to see, here's a challenge for you. One thing I'd love to see as part of your tenure is a community pharmacy consultant pharmacist in Scotland. Could you commit to that?
I'm not going to commit to that, Jonathan, because I guess we don't have a policy in consultant pharmacists in Scotland yet. So, and whilst I may be chief pharmaceutical officer, I also I'm responsible to ministers. So there's something around ensuring that whatever policies we have are part of what the overall kind of strategy of the government of the day is. So there's a balancing act to be played there. And I guess there's a bit around for us to think about as a profession. Is it a consultant community pharmacist we want, or do we recognise community pharmacists as being in the same way that GPs do, expert generalists in pharmacy? So there's something for me about what's the problem that we're trying to solve, and then what's the best way to actually kind of do that. So let's dig down into the root cause and think about how do you then build it up from what you know about what's out there. So I think one of the problems we have is we're labelled sometimes by the sectors we work in, as opposed to seeing ourselves as being clinical pharmacists. Everybody now qualifies with a master's in pharmacy, so rather than getting caught in some of this kind of sectoral stuff, we actually kind of recognize that we all have something to contribute, and we switch it on its head. And it's a bit like, how do you eat the elephant? Well, you eat it bit by bit because you can't eat it as a whole. So, I think we need to think about, it's a bit like form and function. So let's try and get the practice models right, and then let's think about how we might label them or how we might get into that, because I'm not so sure the labels are that important
Yeah, no,
in the
I
big
agree,
picture of it.
and they're actually that my fault for bringing up the term consultant pharmacist, because that's down in England and elsewhere, that's that comes with all sorts of baggage. What I do agree with you on though is some kind of, I think it's really important if we're talking at profession level to find, like you say, to find sort of that thread, that golden thread that links every pharmacist, and it's not even about going to the lowest common denominator, but it's just it's just we are all part of the same team, I guess. In terms of deploying that, I think something like a competence passport or I know vaccine passports are controversial, but just that kind of idea that you can carry your competence around and you can demonstrate that and build it over your career. I think that's quite a nice idea. And that sort of, it doesn't do away with the sectors, which are important, but it sort of cuts through that a wee bit, doesn't it?
I think it does, and I think I said at the start, I mean, I think some of our younger pharmacists are more interested in a portfolio career. They don't want to be tied necessarily to one particular setting. Now, with all these things, you've also got to think about what you gain and what you lose, and there's displacement opportunities around the building of relationships if you move around too much. But there is something for me about being able to respond to all of those things. But I also go back to the fact that, I guess how we traditionally do things and the role we had compounding medicines back in the day, we actually might find ourselves a little bit back there in the future when you think about some of the new disruptive technologies that are coming along, some of the gene and cell therapies, and actually the desire to be able to I guess think about somebody's genetic makeup and ensure that the medicine they're getting is the best medicine for them based on that knowledge and information. And regardless of where you might be practicing, I'd like to think you have access to the information that allows you to then
Sure.
work with a patient, whether that be in a community pharmacy setting or in a GP practice or in a hospital or somewhere virtually in between, because you're an interface pharmacist working between all those kind of sectors. So I think you are right. There's something going back to saying what binds us all together. How do we make sure that we've got our basic education and training right, that we've got a way of being able to support people through lifelong learning that enables them to live to have fulfilling and enjoyable careers, but also responds to some of the external factors that are coming along, such as new therapies and new ways of delivering medicines to people. So, precision medicines, which might require us to think quite differently to the more traditional way that we have around how to, diagnose and treat patients. And I guess going right back to the bit of pharmacists being the experts in medicines, I guess what we need to be able to ensure is that we've got pharmacists plugged in to be supporting the decisions about what is the right medicine for that patient.
You see, there's a couple of words, like I know you're pushed for time, but there's a couple of words that I like that not concern me, but raise radar or something with me. Like resilience is one previously. Well-being, I mean resilience particularly because that assumes they're a problem.
I don't want to put my head in the sand and pretend that we've not had a really challenging time, right across the health service. But our community pharmacists have had their doors open right throughout the pandemic, and had to deal with some very testing times at points when their workload, doubled to what it normally would be. So it would be remiss of me not to recognise that that can't have had an impact on people. And everyone I speak to in the health service, the key thing that they talk about is just how tired the workforce is right now, and I think we have to acknowledge that, and we have to think about how do we support people in that situation. We shouldn't be in that situation, of course, and that goes back to my point about how do we also make sure that people are working in environments that are safe and that they have the right staffing levels and that they actually feel supported. So I suppose my bit about resilience is about thinking around how do we make sure that we are supporting our workforce as best we can, and some of that may not be a problem in some areas and it may be more of a problem in others, but I think we do need to be thinking about that. And it gets into that bit, doesn't it, about empathy and leadership that's focused in on kind of kindness and compassion. And I think I don't see resilience as being entirely negative. I see it as acknowledging that we've asked a lot of people, and they haven't had much opportunity to have a break, and we're about to go into the winter period again. So I think it is about trying to recognise that these have to be issues, and we need to think about how we address them in a way that supports individuals.
Couple of quick questions to finish. The first one's a bit tricky, but I'm sure you'll make it positive. And the second one is some so maybe have a think about it first is having a think about what your message to the next generation of pharmacists coming through is. But before that, one I wrote an article And it was a frivolous kind of article. It wasn't very like, you know, it was just a point I was making, you know, an observation, shall we say. And the observation was, given that, you know, I think it's fair to say that the COVID vaccine was, you know, arguably one of the most profound pharmaceutical interventions globally, probably in you know in our generation. I mean, we could argue the toss about that, but it was up there. And you know, when lockdown happened, they take you back to March 2020, and Chris Whitty came up, and all the guys up here, Jason Leach, and they were all at the, you know, at the pulpit there, doing the daily press conferences. An observation of mine that there was, correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't think there was ever a pharmacist, and that sort of jarred with me, because it's not necessarily a criticism of you, but there's a gap in my understanding there around why a pharmacist wouldn't be involved in a discussion around the vaccine, especially when, you know, you mentioned about, you know, us being experts in medicines. I would gently challenge that as well. I would say, are we really? I think we need to demonstrate that we are through competence-based learning and so on. But the point remains, have you got any thoughts on that? Why were there no pharmacists sort of leading the national narrative? And what does that say about our profession, really?
So I would start by saying, I guess you can't have everybody on the platform, you know,
Indeed.
because at the end of the day, you know, there's a finite amount that isn't then just repeated by everybody. So I think there is an issue about saying, you know, how do you make sure that you're putting the people up that can probably answer the majority of questions in a way that doesn't means say you've got people there not contributing or people just repeating what's been said before. So to be fair, most of the press briefings were led either by the clinical director or the chief medical officer, so along with ministers. And the chief nursing officer, I think, attended some, as did I think the chief of police actually, when it came to issues around particularly I suppose some of the kind of public issues around the kind of social distancing and various things. So I guess, you know, that at the end of the day, you know, I think that's a pragmatic decision, but that's a decision that's made by ministers about who they want to have alongside them. I would say that I actually did an awful lot of behind the scenes press conferences about the vaccines, particularly because they had more of an interest, I guess, in the bits that as a pharmacist you're able to answer, particularly around some of the regulations about splitting down pizza boxes and what you can and do with it, can and can't do within human medicines regulations around that. So I guess it is about playing people to their strengths, to the right audiences. So that really is an answer around that. If you think about the structure of government, whether we like it or not, we're not the largest profession. And you know, I'm not a director, I'm a deputy director within the government kind of structure. So you know, you can see why ministers will want to have somebody who's got, you know, a director status, such as the chief medical officer, to be accompanying them. So I guess that's my answer to that. I do think that the role of pharmacists was acknowledged as what we'd done to support the vaccination programme, and the same goes for pharmacy technicians, actually. There was a lot of praise for the work that technicians did in very complex circumstances at the early stages of the programme, trying to pack down medicines in very kind of difficult kind of you know, sub-zero temperatures. So there's something for me around all of that that we weren't ignored, and we were acknowledged for what we contributed, and we contributed in the places where I think we made the most difference. Do I think standing on a platform, being on the television every day would have been the best use of my time, given that the hours on either side of it to commute to get there and to sit in the bit and the post bit? I more than enough work to be doing to make sure that we were able to really support pharmacy teams at the front line to deliver the vaccination program and to deliver all the other things. So I for me, I sleep easy in my bed at night knowing that pharmacists at the top level of government, right across the NHS and all the way down to the coal face, made that difference, and that's good enough for me. So
Brilliant.
going to your la last on you go.
And to yeah, to end on a positive, really. I mean, I know it's
Yes, your
challenging
last
times,
point was
but
about my
so
words.
what's your thoughts for the next generation?
So, do you know, so I have, if I had been allowed to have a PowerPoint, I have a favourite slide, which I stole from Jason Leach actually, which is about your comfort zone. So, you know, we're all very happy in our comfort zone, and as pharmacists in particular, we are very, you know, we are very black and white. We like to live by the rule book, as we know it. And I guess for me, it's when you step out of your comfort zone is where the magic happens, as Jason always says. But I guess for me, it's that bit about do you choose courage or do you choose comfort? And I guess I'd like to encourage people to think about being courageous. You know, there are great opportunities for the profession out there. So as a young pharmacist, or even as somebody my generation, you know that there's so many exciting opportunities for pharmacists, pharmacy technicians, pharmacy support staff to get involved and make a difference. So I guess it's about be curious. That's what we always tell you at university. Ask lots of questions, but you know, be courageous and you know, take some of the opportunities that come your way, because I don't think you'll ever look back.
Well, lovely way to finish. And yeah, and I know you've been very generous with your time, Alison. And just can't thank you enough, really. The conference starts, and we're sort of publishing, a session every day for the next 3 weeks. So it's a little bit different to the norm. But I guess that's a good example of stepping out of the comfort zone. I don't
Indeed.
really recognize any norms in that space. So we're going to do it the way our readers and so on want it and have told us they want it. So just absolutely delighted to speak to you. Loads of people will be really, really intrigued and pleased with what you've said. And yeah, look forward to chatting again, and wish you all the best.
Thanks very much, and good luck with the conference. I like the idea that you're doing it in bite-sized chunks, because I think that makes it really digestible for people as well. So I hope everyone enjoys the next 3 weeks.
Absolutely. Plus, you're going first, so everybody will watch you.
Well,
You're
let's hope it
confident
doesn't
in
put
it.
them off.
Oh, not at all. Not at all. Yeah, no, thanks very much, Alison. See you soon.
Thanks, Jonathan.